From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
Frankly, the sentiment against Bonds has existed long before he ever started developing those shoulders and biceps. I mean, it goes back to his early days in Pittsburgh. He's never been media-friendly, and now he's paying a price for it.
Barry Bonds' perjury trial was scheduled to begin on Monday, but a last-minute appeal has guaranteed it will start no earlier than the year 2034. Ahead on Only a Game, legal experts and Bonds observers weigh in on the interminable Bonds saga and a conversation with Jim Reisler, author of The Best Game Ever, Pirates vs. Yankees, October 13, 1960. Also ahead, a World Baseball Classic preview and Tiger returns to the fairways and burns brightly enough for now. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Barry Bonds, who holds the Major League record with 762 career home runs, was scheduled to go on trial for perjury and obstruction of justice in San Francisco on Monday. But late yesterday afternoon, prosecutors appealed Judge Susan Ilston's decision to disallow some of the evidence they had planned to introduce in the trial. The appeal will delay court proceedings perhaps for months. Bonds has been charged with 10 counts of making false statements to a grand jury and one count of obstruction of justice in connection with the investigation of steroids in baseball and of the California laboratory Balco that provided performance-enhancing drugs to various athletes. Lance Williams, co-author of Game of Shadows, a book about Bonds and other athletes linked to Balco, has been following the events leading up to the trial for 6 years.
Back in 2003, when a federal grand jury was investigating steroid dealing at Balco, Bonds was among 30 or so elite athletes brought in to answer questions about documents and other information the government had. He was shown doping calendars, positive drug tests, and other material, and asked if he wasn't using steroids provided by his trainer, Greg Anderson. Bonds denied it.
Greg Anderson has consistently refused to testify against his former client. He did so again yesterday afternoon. He will not confirm that the BB notations on the Balco calendars refer to Bonds or that the positive drug tests are his, which was why Judge Ilston threw out the calendars and the tests. Though some observers regard that decision as a critical victory for Bonds, Lance Williams feels there was still ample evidence for the jury to consider.
There's a recording of Anderson, the trainer, made without his knowledge by Bonds' business manager, discussing the regimen of undetectables that Greg said he was giving to the home run king, and that'll come in. And finally, there's a former personal assistant who is going to testify she watched Anderson inject Bonds. But it's important to note that in the grand jury testimony, Bonds said nobody had ever injected him with anything except his doctor.
The government has invested a great deal of time and money in the pursuit of Barry Bonds. Will the result of this prosecution turn out to be worth the effort? Jim Litke of the Associated Press hopes for at least some sense of closure regarding the issue of performance-enhancing drugs in baseball.
It's a good thing only in the sense that it's one more piece of a puzzle, and we still don't have enough pieces. But more to the point, I mean, I think it's important to know how many guys we're using, because we need some way to measure these accomplishments, because, you know, that is one of the most alluring things about the game, is being able to compare era to era. Mm-hmm. And this supersized era has definitely thrown it out of whack.
For some who've been observing the development of the Bonds case since the Balco arrests, matters more significant than baseball statistics are at stake. Dave Zirin, the author of A People's History of Sports in the United States and a contributor to The Nation, is especially concerned with what he maintains are liberties taken by IRS agent Jeff Nowitzki, who, Zirin says, far exceeded the powers granted in search warrants he'd obtained.
And he went in there with a warrant to get the drug tests for 10 pro baseball players, and he left with 4,000 records of every baseball player in the country, many athletes, and two private companies. And a three-judge panel later referred to this as an absolute breach of the Bill of Rights. One judge even asked if the Fourth Amendment had been repealed without their knowing it. And as soon as government agents start acting in such a manner, to me it goes way above and beyond whether you're a Barry Bonds booster or whether you hate steroids, and all of a sudden it becomes a case that concerns all of us.
Almost since arriving in the major leagues with the Pirates in 1986, Bonds has been contemptuous of the press and distant from many of his teammates. Zyron believes the slugger's reputation has worked against him. Regarding that sentiment, he gets no argument from Chuck Finder of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
He has the statistics of a Hall of Famer. He has the statistics of the greatest baseball player to ever don a Pirates uniform. And they have statues of Roberto Clemente and Willie Stargell in front of PNC Park. But boy, there'd be a lot of dead bodies to get a Barry Bonds statue in front of PNC Park.
How long the delay occasioned by yesterday's appeal will last is uncertain. But whenever the trial of Barry Bonds does go forward, there can be little doubt that it will represent the most closely watched court case involving a baseball player since Shoeless Joe Jackson and his fellow Black Sox won acquittal 88 years ago. The good news for Tiger Woods, returning to the golf course 8 months after knee surgery, was that the knee felt fine. The bad news was a South African golfer named Tim Clark who knocked Woods out of the Accenture Match Play Championship on Thursday. Woods is expected to play next in 2 weeks at the CA Championship at the Doral Club in Miami. Joining me now to discuss what the return of one of the world's most accomplished athletes means to golf is Damon Hack, whose article about Tiger Woods appears in the current issue of Sports Illustrated. Damon, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Let's begin by talking a little golf. Tiger didn't exactly look rusty on the first two holes he played in the Accenture Match Play Championship on Wednesday, did he?
He really did, and I know for me personally, I expected him to be a little rusty just because you're thinking 8 months off, a knee surgery, and hitting practice balls and playing at your home course isn't the same thing as going out and competing on the PGA Tour, but as Tiger is wont to do, he comes out and makes birdie on his first hole and an eagle on his second. And, you know, all of the fears that I had were assuaged, and he went out and won his first match. And Tiger would not have shown up in the Tucson desert unless he was ready to play and ready to win.
I'm sure there were lots of people watching him in the Tucson desert. After the birdie on the first hole and the eagle on the second, was there great disappointment that he didn't get a hole in one on the third?
There has to be a little bit. We expect so much out of Tiger. You know, he's almost like a Superman to us now. He's done so many things in his career. Only 33 years old. He's won a Masters by 12 shots, a U.S. Open by 15 shots. He's won a British Open by 8 shots. And, of course, last year winning the U.S. Open on one good leg. We expect the hole-in-ones and the eagles and the double eagles and the incredible talent that he brings. And it never gets old to me. And I'm glad that he's back and healthy and that he's still really an athlete in his prime, 33. Ben Hogan won a ton of major championships. Nicholas, of course, won at the age of 46 at the Masters in 1986. So you get the feeling that Tiger's going to be around for a while, wreaking havoc on the PGA Tour and causing his opponents headaches.
In the Sports Illustrated article you wrote about his return to the tour, you contend that the weight of the game rests on his reconstructed knee. Hyperbole?
I really don't think so. I say that, you know, having watched the game over the last 8 months and seeing people really not react to the game without Tiger. I mean, with the exception of the Ryder Cup, which I believe had interest because the U.S. had done so poorly over the years, golf was really under the radar as far as the general sports fan is concerned. And it was interesting walking around, talking to strangers, family members, and friends over the last 8 months. The question, when's Tiger coming back? I mean, these are football fans or people that maybe don't even like golf very much, but they know Tiger Woods, they know who he is, and they know that when he's on television, the game feels different than when he's not.
Since Tiger Woods had his knee repaired, a lot of the corporations and institutions that have sponsored golfers and tour events have suffered financial reversals, General Motors, of course, and various ailing banks that have also had a considerable presence in pro golf. Can the return of one player, albeit an exceptionally good player, do much to encourage those corporations to put their diminishing number of eggs back in the golf bag, to mix a metaphor ridiculously?
It's tough in this economy. I mean, you see the problems that GM has had, and you have to wonder when they're sitting in their board meetings how they could justify renewing a contract with Tiger Woods. I mean, Tiger Woods is not an inexpensive person to sponsor, you know, and I think that a lot of these companies are having to make difficult decisions. But at the same time, to have the Tiger Woods brand, to be affiliated with it, you know, you're going to have someone fill in that spot. For example, you know, Buick is no longer his sponsor, but AT&T replaces the logo on his bag now. So you have Nike, you have AT&T, you have American Express. You still have companies that want to be identified with Tiger and believe it's important enough to help their brand to have Tiger Woods affiliated with them. But there's no question about it. The downturn, the economy, the questions that sponsors and companies have to ask themselves, whether they can afford it, it's a fair question because everyone is dealing with that. And the golf world is not immune from that as well.
As you've written, Tiger Woods has said that he considers himself, quote, a golfer, not a savior. But has any other individual in any other sport ever been the object of such enormous expectations from the organization managing the sport?
I really don't think so. I mean, the only thing I can compare it to is Michael Jordan when he left the game for a couple of years to try out baseball and get away from the media spotlight. But you still had, it was a team game. You still had fascinating teams and other great players. You still had Patrick Ewing. You still had, you know, Shaquille O'Neal and other players. I've never seen a sport, to me, where the gap between the best player and the rest of the tour is so large. It's an amazing thing to have one player really carry the sport on his shoulders, and that's what Tiger is and represents to the PGA Tour. And it's the way that he looks, the way that he walks, the way that he wears his hat, the way that he hits the ball, his smile, his fist pumps. He is, you know, tailor-made for television in the way that Arnold Palmer was. He brings you in, and you just don't want to turn off the television or change the channel.
I have to gather from what you're saying, Damon, that you are anticipating that Tiger Woods will just have a dandy 2009 season.
Call me crazy, but I've seen it so many times before. There are questions about how Tiger would react to being, you know, a husband, and, oh, well, he'd be distracted. And then there were questions about, oh, he's making a swing change. You know, is that going to affect him? And, oh, he has a baby, and he has two babies. Maybe he won't be as focused. And instead, he was inspired and wanted to be great for his kids. I mean, Tiger Woods, from a young age, has been, you know, wired and bred and built to win golf tournaments. And he loves it. And that's a rarity to have someone who's accomplished so much already continue to be hungry, continue to enjoy the competition inside the ropes. And I, as a sports fan and as a golf writer, I feel very lucky to be able to be there inside the ropes on occasion and watch him wield his magic.
Damon Hack's article about Tiger Woods appears in the March 2nd issue of Sports Illustrated. Damon, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Middlesbrough currently stands next to last in England's Premiership, meaning that if they can't climb at least two places, they'll face relegation. It's a situation that would seem to call for all the support the struggling team's fans could manage. So imagine the surprise in the noisy southeast corner of the Middlesbrough grounds last weekend when management distributed a letter citing complaints about the constant noise from that section and asking fans to be quiet except when the team scored. The letter also urged fans to refrain from standing up during the game, though it stopped short of suggesting that Middlesbrough supporters should just stay home. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the best game ever, especially if you're a Pirates fan. But first, the second World Baseball Classic kicks off on Thursday when Japan hosts China. First and second round games will be ongoing through March 18th at far-flung diamond hubs like Tokyo, Mexico City, Toronto, San Juan, Puerto Rico, San Diego, and Miami. The finals take place on March 23rd in Los Angeles. Here to preview the 2009 World Baseball Classic is Jeff Blair of the Globe and Mail. Jeff, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be on again.
Japan won the 2006 tournament with the help of pitching phenom Daisuke Matsuzaka and his mysterious gyro ball. Will enough of the hitters at this year's World Baseball Classic have figured out Daisuke to make it tough for Japan to repeat?
Well, I think when you look at the World Baseball Classic, a lot of people will automatically make Japan the favorite going in, not just because of Daisuke, but they also have a pitcher named Yu Darvish, who is the most talked about pitcher in the international scene right now. He's of mixed Japanese and Iranian parentage. I mean, everybody you talk to says that this guy is far ahead of where Daisuke was in the same stage of his career. He's much taller. He's a terrific athlete. But I have to tell you, after seeing the Olympics and after seeing what they did in the first World Baseball Classic, I wouldn't count out the Koreans. They play precisely the type of baseball that wins in these type of tournaments. They've got a lot of veteran pitchers who probably aren't going to be familiar to a lot of the North American players. They just know how to win big international games.
What about the level of play across the board? 16 teams will compete in this year's tournament, and they are the same teams that participated 3 years ago. But has there been a significant improvement or maybe a falling off among them?
Not to dodge the question, I think it's probably going to be the same. There'll be a falling off, I think, with the Americans because, clearly the best American pitchers aren't going this time. Same with the Venezuelans. There'll be no Johan Santana. I don't believe Carlos Zambrano will be there. Canada, which has a chance of winning its pool, quite frankly, because of its lineup, does not have any of its established major league pitchers. And, the wild card in all this are the Cubans. They've made a lot of changes from their Olympic team. They've certainly made a lot of changes from the team that was in the last World Baseball Classic, and nobody really knows how good or how bad the Cubans will be. I think on balance, it'll probably be equivalent, but I just don't think the Americans are going to have enough pitching to really go the distance in this tournament.
I assume that some of the pitchers that some of these teams might like to have aren't showing up because their major league employers are just saying, no, too early for you to be out there competing at this level.
Right. And, I'll give guys who are coming off some sort of health issue a pass. But really, what are we asking of these guys? You're asking a couple of innings. There's pitch counts. Beyond that, this is – and I think the players need to realize this. This is a joint venture between the Players Association and Major League Baseball. It's the only way baseball can grow itself internationally because I don't think it's ever going to be back in the Olympics. And even if it is back in the Olympics, the Olympic baseball tournament, because of its timing, will never be the showcase that baseball needs. And I just think it's really short-sighted of the players, and especially the American players. There seems to be this real sense of, who cares about it? It's just kind of a nuisance. And these guys are making a lot of money. I quite frankly think they could give back to the game by taking part in this event.
Jeff, you're a fan of this event, but did the first World Baseball Classic succeed in sort of raising the profile of baseball and enthusiasm for the game around the world?
It certainly did in Asia. I went out for dinner the other night with a Japanese writer, and the Japanese, it's all they're talking about right now. Same thing in Korea. It's a big deal in Korea. You've got, countries like Italy and South Africa and that. They're never going to be baseball hotbeds, regardless of whatever baseball does. But I covered the first event, and the first event was terrific. Just culturally, the baseball was really good. Dodger Stadium was packed to see Korea and Japan play. You've got to figure out a way to grow this thing because I think it's pretty much, baseball's pretty much grown as much as it's going to grow in the United States. And have a little pride in the game, and especially now with the steroid scandal. Do something that is just good and that lives up to the hype and gives people something to look forward to. I don't think it's too much to ask of the players or owners, quite frankly.
One of the attractions of the World Baseball Classic is the opportunity that we'll have to see players we wouldn't otherwise see. This year, former New York Yankees center fielder Bernie Williams will dust off the glove and join Puerto Rico. Can Mr. Williams find some pop in his bat?
He better. Puerto Ricans are kind of an older lineup. But, you know, what's interesting about the tournament this year is, even if you look at the Dominicans, Moises Alou and Pedro Martinez were both free agents and not signed yet. There are players at the WBC who are competing for jobs in what is a really tight player market. There are players who have a lot at stake here. And that may raise it a notch, because there are going to be players in here who need a good performance, or who are looking at a good performance as possibly getting them an invite to a major league camp. There's some good storylines out there.
Do you think it was a good idea to name the tournament the World Baseball Classic? I mean, it does feature teams from around the world playing baseball, but how classic can a tournament that began 3 years ago really be?
Well, I mean, that's the whole issue with the World Series, too. You know, does the best team in North America necessarily constitute being the world champion? This thing was planned to become the World Cup of baseball, essentially. So this was meant to be the showcase for baseball worldwide. I will be fascinated to see how they pull it off this year in this economy. I know, for example, in Toronto, the first game between Canada and the U.S., they've already sold apparently 35,000 tickets for that game. In a lot of ways, this is a sign of what's going to happen this year. Baseball is the first sport since we've been in this depression that has had to go through an entire off-season in the depression. It's had to sell tickets in the off-season. It's had to get corporate sponsorships in it during an economic downturn. And it'll be fascinating to see, A, how it gets through that, B, what happens when the regular season starts. Will people still come out to the ballparks? And I think this will be a bit of a litmus test to see just how bad baseball will be affected by the economy.
Jeff Blair covers baseball for the Globe and Mail. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.org. Please let us know on which station you hear our program and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860, and you can visit our website, onlyagame.org. During three October baseball games in 1960, the New York Yankees beat the Pittsburgh Pirates so badly that many fans must have wondered if the Pirates belonged on the same ball field as the mighty Yankees. But during four games in that same October, the Pirates found a way to beat the Yankees. In Game 7 of that World Series, the way they found was a ninth-inning home run by Bill Mazeroski. In part for that reason, Jim Reisler considers that game the best one ever, and he's written a book to make his case. No surprise that the book is titled The Best Game Ever. Jim Reisler joins me now from NPR in New York. Jim, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be on with you.
We have the call of the home run that ended Game 7 of the 1960 World Series. Let's review those moments.
Art Ditmar throws. Here's a swing and a high fly ball going deep to left. This may do it. Back to the wall goes Vera. It is. Over the fence. Home run. The Pirates win.
All right. A walk-off home run to end the seventh game. What else contributed to your conclusion that this was, in fact, the best game ever?
Bill, I think there are other probably greater games. There's games that have kind of sociological significance. There are arguably other best or great games. But I think that the thing about this game is that it had everything. Mm-hmm. It had obviously a lot of runs. It had a lot of hits. It had, believe it or not, stretches of good pitching and a surprisingly well-played game. You think a game with 19 runs and 24 base hits, there'd be about 16 errors. There was one. It was an outfield bobble by Roger Maris that really didn't amount to anything. And it was a very quick game.
A quick 19-run game.
You know, you think about those Yankees-Red Sox games, 10 to 9, it takes them 5 hours. This game was over in 2.5 hours. Absolutely amazing. And I think for all those reasons, I think it really was arguably the best game ever.
If the Pirates had gone out in order in the ninth inning of the seventh game of the 1960 World Series, and if, say, Mickey Mantle had homered with two out in the top of the 10th to win it for the Yankees, would you have considered that drama the best game ever?
That's put me on the spot, isn't it? I would probably say no, because as you said in your intro, part of this was about the Pirates and the really improbable way they won this. I mean, the six games before that, the Yankees had won three and the Pirates had won three. The Yankees had won their three games by 32 runs. They outscored the Pirates 35-3. That's not a misprint. The Pirates had won three games by a total of 6 runs. So, I mean, the fact that they were even there, they were hanging around, is really improbable. And part of it, too, I think, that really makes it an epic game, at least in Pittsburgh history, is that the Pirates hadn't won a World Series at that point in 35 years. Mm-hmm. And the Yankees were there a lot of times before. They'd go again throughout the early 60s. So probably if the Yankees had won, it probably wouldn't be such a big deal. It would be just sort of another Yankee win, whereas for the Pirates, it was their first one in a long time.
It was also the only World Series in which the most valuable player was a guy on the losing team.
That's right. That's a great trivia question. All these years later, nearly 50 years later, it's still the same answer. It was Bobby Richardson, who was the Yankee second baseman, had an otherworldly World Series. He was Mickey Mantle Square during the whole series, and you talk to him all these years later, and he's a nice guy. And he just said, well, I was seeing the ball well. I had a good series. Those were the Yankees. They put it together when it counted.
You also spoke with Gil McDougald, an infielder for New York, and he told you, and I'm quoting now, deep down, I was happy for the Pirates. In a town like Pittsburgh where they don't win that often, it's a big thing, and we had our share. Were you surprised at that sentiment?
Yeah. To put it in a little bit of context, 1960 was his last year in the major leagues. He hadn't really told anybody at that point, but he knew that it would be his last game. And he describes going into the locker room after Game 7 and undressing in this little cramped locker room. And he took off the uniform, and he was really, in his own way, he was quite emotional about it because his career was ending. But McDougal was a New York Yankee in the 1950s primarily, and he had 10 seasons in the major leagues. He'd been in 8 World Series. This was his 8th World Series, his 52nd World Series game or something. And I think he was just finally kind of relieved to get it over with and saw their opponents, the Pirates, of just a team with a lot of heart and a city that really had a winner for the first time in years, and he was happy for them. A very gracious man he was.
One of the more powerful images in your book, at least for me, has Roberto Clemente celebrating the World Series championship with the Pittsburgh fans rather than with his partying teammates. How was it that the other Pirates had not entirely connected with Clemente? He'd been their teammate since 1955.
Yeah, interesting question, Bill. I think he was a veteran, not a grizzled veteran, but definitely a veteran. He was an all-star in 1960. He hit over 300. I think he hit 314 that year. But he wasn't yet the complete superstar that he would become. He was still undisciplined at the plate. He had a strike zone that was all over the place. But I think the press didn't really accept him. It was a long time ago. They used to actually quote him sort of verbatim. He didn't speak English really well. He felt a little bit insulted by that. And I think he felt that some of his teammates didn't really accept him. But he always felt, and I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I felt, too, that the fans always accepted him for who he was. He was a great player, obviously, and he was a hard worker.
I'm speaking with Jim Reisler, author of The Best Game Ever. You're listening to Only a Game. You close The Greatest Game Ever with a description of a group of fans who still annually celebrate what the 1960 Pirates accomplished. Tell us a little bit about their ritual.
Oh, it's a great thing. I've only been there once. But Forbes Field is obviously not there anymore. It was torn down in 1970. It was taken over by the University of Pittsburgh, who built a couple of big buildings sort of right plop right on where the ballpark used to be. But there's a part of the old outfield wall that's still there. Every October 13th, people show up at the site of approximately where Mazeroski's ball went over the left center field, the 406 mark. There's a little plaque there. There's not much, though. There's a sign and a little plaque. And somebody brings a boombox, and they play the tape of the entire game. And they listen to the game, and they're sitting around, and they're rooting for it. And they're thinking, come on, he could. I mean, it's like they're listening to it for the first time. And good stuff happens, and they break into cheers. And Mazeroski hits the ball, and they all give each other high fives, and they all go home and come back the next year. It's absolutely wonderful. It's a really nice kind of ad hoc communal thing every October 13th. I highly recommend it if you're in the neighborhood.
The Pirates won the World Series again in 1971 and in 1979 as well, but these days they're awful, and the Pittsburgh Steelers are the pride of the city, which also celebrates Pittsburgh Penguin star Sidney Crosby. Does anybody pay attention to the Pirates of today?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I mean, quick, Bill, name five Pirates. I can't. It's just... It's a shame because they have a wonderful ballpark. They have a wonderful ballpark. They just have a terrible team. And it's not that they're truly horrendous every year. It's just that they're sort of relentlessly mediocre. They haven't had a winning season. I think it's 16 or 17 years now. It's since Barry Bonds played for them, for goodness sakes. They've kind of lost a generation of young kids. They get 17-year-olds and who don't remember the Pirates ever winning. It's really sad.
Jim Reisler is the author of The Best Game Ever, Pirates versus Yankees, October 13th, 1960. The book is published by DeCapo Press, and Jim Reisler joined me from NPR in New York. Jim, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Oh, this was a lot of fun, Bill. Thank you.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The producers of television commercials in China are unencumbered by regulations regarding the rights celebrities have to their images in other countries. As a result, an ad featuring old video footage of David Beckham and touting the properties of a Viagra-style product includes an enthusiastic voiceover. "Want to know how I can keep running on the football field?" David Beckham allegedly asks. "These capsules help me a lot. It's also the secret weapon with which I can satisfy Victoria." Sports stars are not the only ones whose images and words are being manipulated. A commercial for the same product features Sean Connery saying, "With the help of these capsules, I'm James Bond, forever 25. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, gymnasts may peak early. We'll be taking a peek at some who've stayed late. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
There has been much discussion about how credit has been frozen and loans have been very hard to come by lately. But if you're the National Basketball Association, you can still borrow to the tune of $200 million. The league has done so to help 12 anonymous teams that have requested financial assistance. So, money well spent?
I'd like to give David Stern credit for coming up with one of the greatest pile of bull cookies in the history of professional sports. 12 teams or so are going to get $200 million in loans that the NBA has gotten to spread around to these 12 teams. And David Stern told the AP, "This is the exact opposite of a bailout. This is a show of strength in the creditworthiness of the NBA's teams." And he's so proud of this and so proud of the NBA's creditworthiness, he's not going to tell you which of the 12 teams it is.
No, it's anonymous.
Guess what? It's a bailout.
Meanwhile, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell took a 20% pay cut this week, maybe because he just doesn't think he did a very good job last year.
Good for him. I hope the news of this filters a little bit around Manhattan and winds up in Bud Selig's office.
Injured New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady has now gone beyond the pursuit of everything
to the acquisition of
that's a little book plug for
thank
you.
Thank you.
He has acquired nearly everything, having reportedly married the world's highest paid supermodel, Gisele Bündchen, on Thursday. Maybe the couple can now be the NFL's go-to financial resource if things get really tough.
Well, I'm a little bit sorry there was no video, because not only did Bündchen wear a gown from Dolce & Gabbana, her three dogs wore matching lace collars. And this is
nowhere... No, I'm sorry there weren't photos.
And this story is nowhere near as weird as it's going to get.
No, I'm sure not. On the first spring training game day for the Yankees, Alex Rodriguez hit a home run, but then he left the park with Yuri Sukart, A-Rod's cousin, the guy who had reportedly supplied him with performance-enhancing drugs. How happy can his employers have been about the company A-Rod was keeping after the game?
Well, Yuri has been banned from the ballpark,
so
as
that's
they
that.
Say.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think this was the smartest PR move in a month where he hasn't made very many smart PR moves.
Manny Ramirez has turned down the latest Dodgers contract offer, $45 million for 2 years. I like this because it's another example of Manny being Manny despite Scott Boras being Scott Boras, don't you think?
At this point, even Scott Boras must be in his office pounding his head off the surface of the desk. Boras has said he doesn't reject the offer. He's going to give them a counterproposal within the framework of the structure we had agreed upon. I believe Scott Boras and David Stern learned English from the same teacher who didn't know much about it himself.
If those two were to talk to each other, would both of their heads explode?
But I'll tell you what would explode. Noah Webster would rise from the dead and his head would explode.
On Thursday, the Washington Nationals fired assistant GM Jose Rijo for his part in the hiring of a Dominican prospect who had lied about his name and his age. I shouldn't laugh at this because a man got fired. But the man he worked for, current Washington Nationals general manager Jim Bowden, could be in deeper trouble for allegedly skimming signing bonuses as far back as 1994 when he was working for the Cincinnati Reds. What is it about the Dominican Republic that seems to bring out the criminal element in Major League Baseball?
Well, certainly in the Washington Nationals, it seems to have a bad influence. You know, this would be a devastating scandal even if the Washington Nationals were ever going to be a good baseball team. But since they're never going to be a good baseball team anyway, this just gets worse and worse.
New York Knicks outcast Stephon Marbury joined the Boston Celtics yesterday to prepare with his new team for the NBA stretch run. Marbury has always polarized opinions. Do you think he'll help or hurt the Celtics as they move toward the playoffs?
Well, there's a lot of meeping and noise in Boston about how he will disrupt the chemistry, but this seems to be coming from people who believe that the Boston Celtics are made up of players made of candy glass. This is a very tough team, a very together team, a very aware team. Stephon Marbury will fit in or he will simply be dispatched.
In a special primary on Tuesday, 15 candidates competed for spots in the final election that will determine the next mayor of Detroit. Only one NBA Hall of Famer was in the running. Fair to say he was head and shoulders above the other contenders?
Dave Bing, 6'3 and 185 during his playing days, by the way. So he's head and shoulders above some of them, I'm sure. He's been a businessman in Detroit for a long time since retiring. And it's really quite a thing. He will be running against the incumbent in a May 5th runoff election. And there's one thing Dave Bing could always do, and that was run.
University of Connecticut men's basketball coach Jim Calhoun earned his 800th career win on Wednesday, lamentably at the expense of the Golden Eagles.
But... Who? No, there's no team in Milwaukee called the Golden Eagles. No.
At the expense of Marquette.
Thank you.
Calhoun has not elicited universal praise this week, however.
Well, yeah, he had this weird encounter at a press conference where he began doing exactly the right thing, which was sort of chuckle questions about his salary off, and then went full red-faced hysterical crazy on some guy. And at least two of the members of the state legislature want him reprimanded. The governor has said bad things about him. Then he went out to Milwaukee and beat Marquette for his 800th win. I'm not exactly sure where you go with this except to say that Calhoun should lighten up a little bit. He's got everything he's ever wanted.
What do you think of the way Paul James, an Australian personal trainer, has addressed the issue of his inability or previous inability to relate to overweight gym members that he trains?
He got fat. He's gaining, he's going to pile on, as the Sun, the newspaper in London, says, more than 7 stone! He's stuffing his face with kebabs, pasta, cream sauces, chocolate, and has even started drinking beer, having been the only Aussie in the history of the world who never drank beer.
This sounds like fun to me.
Meanwhile, elsewhere in the news of bad English bodies.
Oh, yes. On Valentine's Day, James Miller stripped to his shorts and ran across the field at Ewood Park in England, where Blackburn Rovers were playing a soccer match against Coventry City. Mr. Miller also launched a dozen red roses from a bow, all in order to impress his girlfriend. And how did that work out for Mr. Miller?
Miss Thompson, a fashion and textiles student, said, quote, "He must think it's funny, but after that, I didn't want anything to do with him." So if you had
if you had
James Miller and a wedding in September, you lose.
And finally, Charlie, I submit to you a story demonstrating that hockey is hockey, regardless of who happens to be playing it.
Yes, sledge hockey, which is designed for people who have lost the use of their legs, was being played, and apparently a massive brawl broke out. And if you think I'm pursuing this story any further than I just did, you're out of what's left of your mind.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Charlie?
I'm not saying a word. You can't make me.
I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. This summer, Americans tuned in to watch the high-flying routines of Nastia Lukin, the big smiles of Sean Johnson, and the grit of the underdog American men's gymnastics team. Despite its popularity on TV, competitive gymnastics is losing ground in this country. Fewer colleges are offering scholarships to athletes, and some high schools are canceling programs due to lack of participation. But there's one sector of the gymnastics world that seems to be growing. From New York, Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Arms up, take your arms to help you rotate.
Like everything else in Manhattan, the field house at Chelsea Piers Gymnastics Training Center is supersized, with dozens of beams, bars, rings, and vaults, and mountains of multicolored foam. Jamal Story looks the part of a proud papa, pointing a video camera at Charles Clinton making his first attempt at a simple handspring into the foam pit.
Is he stuck in the pit? Oh!
Except Jamal isn't a proud papa. He's another student in this class. And as Charles grudgingly admits, he's a little older than your average first-time gymnast.
Oh, wow. Okay, I'm 38.
Charles jokes that he's too old to start training for the Olympics. And as the only first-timer in a Monday night intermediate class, he's in a bit over his head.
It is terrifying. It's terrifying, but you know what? I'm here and I figure, you know, let me go for it and see what happens.
Charles describes himself as a reasonably fit guy with no knowledge of gymnastics. His friend Jamal is a professional dancer who trained in the sport as a kid and got back into it when asked to make a tumbling pass 8 times a week on Broadway. Now he entertains the Monday night crowd with the graceful flips and tucks he takes just for fun. Charles pretends to be unimpressed.
With a few more practices, I think maybe another 2 or 3 lessons, I should get that. Yeah, by the end of the day, I think I'll have it all down.
Do you even know what that was? I don't even know what that was.
I have no idea. I certainly can invite him over and ask him what that was.
Yeah, I think we'll ask him.
Right. Jamal, one moment.
What is that you just did?
Roundout backhand swing, double back.
And your friend here just told me he thinks maybe 2-3 more lessons he'll be ready to try it.
Thereabouts, 2 or 3 more. Right.
Oh, not bad. Now squeeze your bottom so that it's not wiggling. Okay?
Instructor Joey Garcia likes to tell people that his youngest student is less than a year and a half old, and his oldest is 67. Adult gymnastics is growing around the country. A MySpace group dedicated to the sport lists gyms in 32 states that offer classes. But none come close to the 13 classes a week at Chelsea Piers. With 450 registered participants, Chelsea Piers boasts the largest adult gymnastics program in the world.
A lot of them are performers. A lot of them are dancers, choreographers. We have some kung fu people here, capoeira. It's random, and some people just want to do it just because they did it as a kid and want to continue it, or they never did it as a kid, and now their parents are not rule of their life, so they come and decide to do it. You know, so it's fun. It's a good workout.
Joey starts his class with 25 minutes of stretching. Older bodies need more time to get loose, and a warm-up of 5 minutes of intense push-ups and sit-ups. If that's not enough to make his students sore the next day, the following hour of handstands, forward rolls, and back springs is sure to do the trick. When they need firing up, Joey likes to give his students nicknames.
Let's go, Dominique.
Dominique is 35-year-old Eddie Ryder. Unlike most of his classmates, Eddie never really left gymnastics, except to take time off for broken ankles and wrists, but still finds his experience with the sport as an adult to be very different than when he was a kid.
When I was younger, it was challenging. It kept you busy. You know, you always felt like accomplished. My motivations are different now. When I was younger, it was I'm going to try to do this and land it perfectly. And as I got older, I'm like, all right, if I get this, I get a, you know, apple martini at the end of the night. Whatever gets me through the day sometimes.
Eddie would still compete if he could. The Masters division of the Empire Games was recently canceled due to budget cuts, but he's not likely to take the same risks.
I'm more afraid because when I was younger, you didn't have that sense of responsibility and, oh my gosh, if I break something, can I go to work and can I do my job? There's a lot more bandaging now. There's a lot more taping up and a lot more mats. But my sense of daredevil is kind of there, but it's tempered by realism of what my body can do now at my age.
Recently, Eddie gave up working as a gymnastics instructor and got a job at a hedge fund. But he hasn't yet told his coworkers about his weekly visit to the gymnastics center.
It's just like a big frat house, and everybody did basketball or hockey. And so I'm like, all right, the second I tell them I did gymnastics, every time something goes on there, I'm like, oh my God, I do a flip. And I'm not a monkey. Like, I don't do that anymore. Like,
well, hopefully okay. They won't hear this.
Oh, probably not. It's only NPR, right?
It's a few minutes before the start of the Tuesday night beginners class, and Rachel Harwich is watching a group of preteens practice their floor exercises.
I'm kind of intimidated right now looking at all the little kids swimming around, but they're tiny and flipping everywhere, and I'm going to be embarrassed in front of them, I think. But I'm just hoping there's a lot of people who haven't done this for a long, long time, that I'm not the only one.
Rachel won't be the only newcomer tonight, but instructor Adam Johnson says adults who come back to the gymnastics center shouldn't set their sights on being as accomplished as a third grader.
Absolutely not, because the adults are here for an hour and a half once a week. These girls are in the gym sometimes, I'd say 6 or sometimes 7 days a week, you know, during meet season, and they log some serious hours. So the answer is no, but you know, a lot of these people, I've seen a lot of improvement, you know, just from, there was a guy in here, it's his fourth class, and he's made a lot of improvement, and that's for someone who's, you know, 6 foot and, you know, 100 some odd pounds.
Adults aren't as flexible as kids. Physics doesn't allow them to squeeze out an extra revolution, and certainly they're more hampered by the knowledge of their own mortality. But Adam says adults do have one small advantage over kids.
Absolutely. I think they're more thankful. They want to be here. Like, they're, you know, paying money to be here on their own. So in that respect, they're not going to be, you know, lazy. They're extremely hard workers because, as I said, you know, they want to be here.
So you're too close now. I don't want you to run right off the edge of the cliff.
Tonight, Adam is working with Stephanie Rooksby, who's giggling her way through her first gymnastics class as an adult.
Not as hard as I thought it was going to be. It's coming back to me slowly, but technique is tricky. You know, I never had a technique before, but getting there.
Stephanie quit gymnastics when she was 10, but continued tumbling as a cheerleader. Now she's having to unlearn some bad habits.
The proper technique for a fold roll and a cartwheel and the basics. And then I suppose once I can practice those at home, then I'll come back and try a little bit more and try some combinations, which I'm looking forward to.
Like Stephanie, most of the adult gymnasts at Chelsea Piers aren't starting from scratch. But instructor Adam Johnson says there's plenty of room for someone who's never before flipped, rolled, or sprung.
You should come on Friday then. There's a lot of people who have never, you know, been into a gym, so they're a bit awestruck. Sometimes we've had up to, you know, 40 people, where half the floor is the more advanced people, you know, former gymnasts and then people who have done it before. Then the other half, you know, people who have not done a forward roll before, have not done a cartwheel. And once they get over the initial, you know, embarrassment, oh, I can't do anything, they end up having a really good workout.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Stop. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Brian Fadham. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's gymnastics photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Jake Schmidt, who returned to gymnastics 4 months ago after taking 10 years off from the sport.
I'm not anywhere near as good technically, but I'll do dumber stuff now, so kind of evens out, I guess.
Yes, it does even out, what with the latest generation of judges carefully scrutinizing not only start value, required elements and skills, but also dumber stuff. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.